Tonight's talk is called A Week on Retreat. The French philosopher Pascal once wrote, "The sole cause of man's unhappiness is that he does not know how to stay quietly in his room." Why? Why is simply being alive such an apparently difficult task? Why isn't man spontaneously content and peaceful? According to the Buddha's teaching, it's because the minds of all unenlightened beings are polluted. What are they polluted by? The Buddha defined four different ways the mind is polluted: through sensual desire, through becoming, through views, and through ignorance. In the Pali language, these mental pollutants are called asavas, a word which is usually rendered in English as canker. The word literally means "that which flows out" and denotes both pus oozing from an abscess and intoxicants which have been fermenting for a long time. The canker of sensual desire is that aspect of mind which seeks stimulation and gratification through transient sensual pleasures, yet, as a result, merely generates boredom, restlessness, and the slavish demand for more. The canker of becoming is the desire for life to be different or better in some way, yet leaves us with a sense of inadequacy about how we are now, and fear that our ambitions will not be realized. The canker of views manifests as fixed opinions, beliefs, and demands that life should be one way and not another. But attachment to any view creates a negative attachment to its opposite, which breeds conflict, both internally and outwardly, and hence much unhappiness. The last type of mental pollutant is ignorance. Underpinning the cankers is a total unawareness of what's what. Blinded by ignorance, no connection is made between the actions performed under the spell of the cankers and the intense dissatisfaction, fear, and conflict that is consequently produced. Like continually throwing chemicals into a river, the incessant drip feed of craving gradually corrupts and destroys the mind. Utterly discontented in the moment and blind to everything but fulfilling selfish urges, man leaves his room, banging the door as he goes, and proceeds to create all the havoc and mischief we see in the world. The Buddha stated that there can be no true contentment and peace of mind until these cankers are destroyed. How are they destroyed? Backed by a commitment to ethical living and mental development, the Buddha's way is to undertake a course of insight meditation, vipassana. Through repeated observation of actual experience, the ignorance that underpins and generates mental pollution is dispelled. In its place, liberating knowledge and vision arises into the true nature of reality, and the flow of corrupting states is cut off forever. Only then are we able to stay quietly in our room. Only then is there true peace and contentment. To do this takes dedication. It requires not just a commitment, but true devotion to ethical living, true devotion to developing the mind, true devotion to generating insight. To this end, meditators need to take time out of the hurly-burly of modern life and spend time on retreat. Jackie James, co-founder of the House of Inner Tranquility, once commented that a week of meditation on a residential course is worth 1 year of daily practice at home. Retreats are constructed in such a way as to give maximum support to the meditator. The most suitable and conducive environment has been created, safe and secure, with few distractions. There is a comprehensive set of rules that help to ensure a harmonious time for everyone. Lack of duties, like cooking and cleaning, offer the meditator a rare opportunity for total involvement with the Dhamma 24 hours a day for a week. This is further enhanced by one-on-one guidance from qualified teachers. Now, those who have been on retreat will know from personal experience the truth of Pascal's words. We are given an empty room, a chair to sit on, and the instruction to rest content in the moment, watching the arising and passing away of things. Yet most of us find that, at least to begin with, we cannot do it. So soon into a six-day retreat, we find ourselves either climbing the walls with restlessness and frustration, or collapsing in a slothful heap, bored out of our minds. Why? Why is it so difficult simply just to sit and be? What is it that creates such inner turmoil? Well, I'm sure you won't be too surprised to hear it's the cankers. The degree to which the mind is polluted by the canker of sensual desire can surprise meditators new to retreats. Some find that they start craving for food in a way and to an extent that they simply never would elsewhere. Speculation concerning what the next meal will consist of becomes rife, and the countdown till it arrives begins almost as soon as the previous meal ends. Apparently one meditator, asked how he got on during a retreat, answered that it was only difficult between mealtimes. Another way this canker corrupts the meditative mind is in the form of desire for comfort. To escape unpleasant feelings and perceptions, the mind loses itself in daydream, fantasy, or sleep. In these ways, the canker of sensual desire overwhelms and pollutes the mind. Taken away from the moment with the promise of pleasure and fulfillment, only to be dumped right back again, bored, restless, frustrated. The canker of becoming is most familiar to meditators in the guise of goal orientation. It's natural enough to want to get somewhere with the practice while we're on retreat. After all, we've dedicated a week of our holiday entitlement to do this, and we want to see some returns on our investment. But ironically, craving for progress takes us away from the moment, away from the only place true progress will ever be made. How does it work? Having an ideal image of what the practice should be like, we make a comparison with actual experience, and then form a judgment concerning our progress. So perhaps our ideal is to have a tranquil mind. On occasions when calm arises, this leads immediately to agitation, elation, because for the time being, our experience fits our ideal image. On occasions when calm is not present, we experience depression, because our ideal and the real are at odds. The result of the canker of becoming is wrong effort. Due to the fear that we are either wasting time, not being productive, or not up to scratch. This example also highlights the way the canker of views pollutes the mind. Elated by our apparent success, we might fall into self-aggrandizement, perhaps picturing ourselves at the end of the retreat, telling everyone in saintly tones about the exact moment we became enlightened. Or, depressed by apparent lack of progress, we fall into self-pity. I can't do this. It's too hard. I'm too stupid. All forms of self-view are mental pollutants. Where there is conceit, communicating with our teacher becomes very difficult. Whether it be pride of age, wealth, upbringing, academic achievement, years of association with the centre, or knowledge of the tamma. From whatever source the comparison springs, it creates a barrier between teacher and student and effectively shuts off any meaningful dialogue. Undoubtedly, some meditators would prefer to tackle the whole enlightenment issue themselves. But without guidance, we remain ignorant of where our practice is out of balance. The result being that we go round and round in circles, like a rowing boat with only one paddle. Forward progress is made by being wide awake and attentive to what is occurring in the present moment. With clear vision, there would be no problem, but we don't have clear vision. The unenlightened mind is polluted by ignorance, and under its dominion, other cankers are perpetually being generated undetected. It's no wonder, with the mind subject to such polluting forces, that resting content in the moment, watching the rise and fall of things, is such a challenge. There is, however, much that can usefully be done to help stem the flow of the cankers on retreat. This part of the talk will offer a few tips on how meditators might ease their passage through the week. Firstly, the amount of time spent settling into the retreat is reduced markedly if we prepare ourselves properly. Tie up any loose ends, leave the house clean and tidy, and give adequate instructions to others in your absence. This will reduce worry and anxiety about life out there while you're in here. Also, make a strong resolve to ease up on worldly activities a few days before the retreat. Increase the amount you meditate and study some tamma to help settle the mind and focus attention. Reflect seriously on why you choose to meditate, what really brings you to the centre, and what you need to do to get the most from your time on retreat. In essence, establish within yourself right view and right intention before you arrive. A Vipassana meditation retreat is not meant to be a holiday. There is work to be done. Meditation is sometimes referred to as kamatana in Pali. Literally, it means field of action, or in more common parlance, workplace. There is no doubt that the practice of insight can and does lead to the arising of tranquility. But if the intention is simply to get into a calm state and stay there for a week, then the true purpose of meditation has not been understood. The Buddha stated, "It is for the full comprehension, realization, wearing down and abandoning of these four floods of sensual desire, becoming, views and ignorance that the Noble Eightfold Way must be cultivated." When we come on retreat, that's exactly what we do. Once the retreat begins, we must sure to be impeccable in keeping to the schedule and house rules. Keeping them impeccably will clearly demonstrate to you, if you needed any clarification, that you are indeed subject to the cankers. For instance, you might be tempted, and it does happen, you might be tempted to bring in a bottle of Coke or a few biscuits to keep under the bed, you know, just in case of emergencies. The food provided here is well prepared, nutritious, and plentiful. The apparent need for more is simply the arising of the canker of sensual desire. Some meditators find that what they are given to eat is not to their liking. Perhaps they have given up eating meat or no longer use wheat in their diet. What arises for them is the canker of views, which floods the mind with justifications and condemnations and can be very disturbing. Our task on retreat is recognizing, accepting, and dealing with the cankers as they manifest. This is why it's crucial to abide by the rules. To wear down and abandon the cankers, you must first have comprehended and realized their existence. Now, this requires another factor to be developed: restraint. Once we are aware of the arising of a canker, we then need to stem its flow. When, for instance, the temptation to miss a meditation arises with the thought, oh, missing one won't do any harm, at that moment, restraint needs to be employed. Now, restraint of the senses means deliberately stemming the flow of sensory information we experience, not allowing the physical senses to rule the mind. By keeping our eyes and our ears to ourselves and not letting them wander, we lessen the opportunities for the mind to become distracted. Many of you, I'm sure, who have been practicing walking meditation around the Japanese garden recently, will have been introduced to the somewhat mad antics of a grey cat that often hangs out there. The cat has been christened Mara, Devil of Temptation. Why? Because so few meditators seem able to resist giving him a good old stroke as they go past. We know he's cute, and I suspect the grey cat knows he's cute too. But restraint goes further than just the physical. It includes restraint of mind also. Consider the bane of many a meditator's practice, wrong effort. Under the influence of the canker of becoming, we try too hard, wrongly believing that maximum effort equals maximum reward, and consequently drive ourselves into the ground. This level of energy cannot be sustained. Even by Tuesday or Wednesday, some are beginning to wilt. We need to learn to pace ourselves, which means learning to restrain over-effort when the urge arises. Now, to restrain the flow of actions that ooze from our canker-ridden minds takes great mindfulness. Another factor essential for success while on retreat. Indeed, you could say the whole practice is founded upon returning again and again to the systematic setting up of mindfulness. Mindfulness is directly opposed to the cankers. Just as the flow of cankers takes us away from the here and now, so mindfulness brings us right back again. According to one teacher, mindfulness is the aware, balanced acceptance of present experience. It isn't more complicated than that. It is opening to or receiving the present moment, pleasant or unpleasant, just as it is, without either clinging to it or rejecting it. So our time on retreat, when not engaged in formal seated meditation, needs to be given over wholeheartedly to this endeavour. We apply ourselves to generating body mindfulness through such mundane activities as eating, making a drink, changing postures, or answering the calls of nature. Through body mindfulness, we return again and again to the here and now. As we do, we naturally become mindful of how we're feeling and the state and content of our mind. Consequently, we become aware of where our thinking is leading us and are able to apply the brakes where necessary. The last tip for success on retreat is on taking instruction. At the House of Inner Tranquility, great emphasis is placed on instruction, and every meditator has 3 interviews of 20 minutes each on a week's course. For a committed meditator, an opportunity to discuss the practice with someone with greater experience of walking the path is priceless. The teacher has already passed through difficulties that the student is currently experiencing and can be of great assistance. But to be of help, the teacher has necessarily to tell us where we're going wrong, and sometimes that can be painful. Being subject to the canker of ignorance, we've become highly proficient at willfully avoiding looking at what's really going on. It's unpleasant being told that we are in error, but consider what the Buddha had to say. Look upon the man who tells you your faults as though he were telling you of hidden treasure. When it works well, the teacher-student relationship becomes a collaboration in overcoming problems, blind spots, and moving the meditation forwards. To overcome barriers to communication, it's essential, therefore, to abide by the proper etiquette. This means things like knocking politely and waiting before being invited to enter the interview room, not wearing slippers to the interview, bringing a suitable gift, and giving the gift in a respectful manner. To recap, to get the most from a retreat, we need to prepare well, behave impeccably, use restraint, develop mindfulness, and accept instruction. Bringing this all together on retreat is not easy. It can begin to feel extremely cramped during the course of a week, as if we're being trapped in a corner or squashed into a little box. This isn't so surprising, really, when you consider what's taking place. If you observe carefully the mind when it is subject to the cankers, you will find that in all cases, such mental pollution is steeped in self-concern. It's the stimulation of my senses. It's what I wish to become. It's ensuring that I get my way. Coming on retreat, the incessant, unhindered flow of the cankers is being temporarily stemmed. As a consequence, our sense of who we think we are, our self-importance, our identity, is also being stunted. But that's exactly what's supposed to happen. The one word that sums it up best is surrender. The concept of surrendering is not one many Westerners find easy to accommodate. However, those who do surrender in the ways outlined find that there is an immense reward. Alan once said, "Surrender is giving up the attachment that I am right. If you do that, then immediately all of the views that you might hold are thrown into question. Suddenly, what was closed becomes open. Suddenly, the boundaries of your universe go all soft and fuzzy because you haven't got any hard edges anymore. It might even be that you go beyond those boundaries." I'm minded of the image of Alice, too big to get through the little door into Wonderland. In the end, she has no alternative but to follow the instructions to drink the contents of a bottle. As a result, she shrinks enough to get through the door. The meditator on retreat is doing something similar. By shrinking self-concern, the attachment to having things our own way, we go beyond our self-imposed boundaries and step into a whole new way of experiencing our universe. Through the lessening of self-concern, the mind gradually quietens down and a new sense of spaciousness develops. Supported by the framework of the retreat schedule and the house rules, we really begin to relax and settle into the practice. We begin to find delight in solitude. Left to our own devices, sitting on a chair in an empty room ceases to be a problem. We begin to appreciate the reason for and the benefits of a disciplined approach to mental development. We win a reprieve from the domination of the cankers, albeit temporarily, through the skillful use of mindfulness and restraint. With the help of the teacher, we learn to put aside wrong views and false expectations about the practice, and with them goes wrong effort. Temporarily freed from the fixed boundaries and limitations the cankers impose, we have the chance to go beyond them, to discover new facets of experience previously hidden to us. This space is the arena of Vipassana, the meditation on the three marks of transience, suffering, and non-self that leads inexorably to permanent freedom from the cankers. We stop ignoring the aspects of reality we previously didn't like and tried to crush out. We stop seeking tranquility for its own sake. Instead, we include all states into our mindful observations, regardless of whether pleasant or unpleasant, and note their nature to arise and pass away. It's important to ensure that when we do see transience, or unsatisfactoriness, or non-self, that we remark strongly to ourselves that this indeed is the case. Only when we are really seeing these three marks and noting them can we say that Vipassana is being done rightly. The fruit of such practice is that from time to time we are presented with a sudden flash of pure insight. These illuminations seem always to arrive unannounced, but they leave an indelible mark in the mind stream. We might, for example, notice a sound arise and pass away very quickly. Nothing unusual there. We may have noted such an occurrence many hundreds of times. But along with it this time comes the clear, intuitive understanding that there was no entity, no me, no self, who either heard the sound or caused hearing to take place. There was most definitely a sound, and there was most definitely hearing, but it all just happened of itself, by itself. An entirely impersonal, conditioned process without an owner of any description. When a true insight like this occurs, the meditator knows it. It is not a product of speculation or wishful thinking. It is a direct realization of how life really is. It is this intuition that, over time, grows and grows into genuine wisdom and understanding. Consider, under the pressure of such true seeing, ignorance cannot be maintained. You can't go on polluting the mind with thoughts of sensual desire, becoming, and views when you know truly that there is nothing to own, nothing to grasp hold of, nothing in all the world that will submit totally to your will or will ever truly satisfy. When it is seen that there is no self, how can self-concern arise? When there is no self-concern, how can the cankers arise? To review, the Buddha maintained that all unenlightened beings are subject to the four mental pollutants of sensual desire, becoming, views, and ignorance. Under their sway, we perform actions that result in misery both for ourselves and others. To be free of them, we must eradicate ignorance of the way life really is. It is for this purpose that a centre like ours exists, offering the necessary supporting conditions for accomplishing this task. Coming on retreat, we are faced directly with the reality of the cankers. Through adequate preparation, impeccability in keeping rules, the practice of mindfulness and restraint, and by communicating openly with our teacher, we gradually learn how to stem their flow. Letting go of self-concern leads us into a new way of experiencing our world and to the generation of intuitive wisdom, which will eventually eradicate the ignorance that causes all mental pollution. So what's it like then, enlightenment? What's it like to have a mind completely purified of all mental dross? What's it like to be free from the incessant demand of sensual thirst and the perennial dissatisfaction that it produces? What's it like to be completely free from the perpetual clamouring for progress, those ambitions that leave you feeling like you're never good enough? What's it like to rest at peace amid all the chaos in the world? To be free from the straitjacket of fixed views and beliefs with all the bigotry and madness that goes with them? What's it like to know exactly how to stay quietly in one's room, or anywhere else for that matter? There are only two ways we can find out what enlightenment is like. One is through listening to or reading the accounts of those great beings who have realized the truth for themselves. The other is to realize the truth for oneself. The House of Inner Tranquility was brought into being by two people who realized the truth for themselves and understood exactly what it takes to succeed. The centre continues to be run in the same way today, and does so for those who are not content merely with the reports of others, but who burn with the desire to find out for themselves. Thank you.